to Smart Mouth. This week we are slightly on the road up in the northern part of LA County. Before we get into it with our guests, though, I want to give a quick thank you to some of our new Patreon subscribers, including friend of the show, Allie Ward. Everybody should go check out her podcast, Ologies. And also Kayleen Terragrossa. Thank you both so much. Also, Emily Ragaglia. I'm so sorry. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it. But she pledged $10 a month, which means she can write into me and ask questions to be answered on the show, on air, whenever she wants. And if anyone else would like to do that as well, it's at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. So thank you, ladies. It's very much appreciated. And now on to the show. Our guest this week is Andrea Crawford. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming on today.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Aw, that's so sweet of you. And it is kind of funny because we have spoken a lot because I am a food journalist who tends to be less interested in restaurants and more into how the food gets there. And you are a farmer.
That's right.
Would you call yourself like a farmer slash anything?
I call myself a farmer, miller, baker, pasta maker, and now I've added shopkeep.
That's a lot.
We've just opened, our bakery, which has a retail component 2 days a week, Wednesdays and Saturdays, and I'm there wearing an apron and selling bread. It's really not so different from a farmer's market since it's only 2 days a week, but it does have a roof over it, and I like that.
Oh, that's different.
It's comfortable.
Yeah.
There's lights.
Yeah. And you're a farmer's market fixture around LA County.
Yes, I have been for years.
Ventura County too?
Or no, just Los Angeles County. Yeah. We just have, you know, the few markets that we do because, you know, we don't have a big enough family to have more markets. Because you have to have family members run them, apparently, if you want to keep them around.
Is that like a rule? Or
it isn't a rule, no. It's just that we found that if we have a family member running it, it really works well.
Oh, so I see.
Yeah, we're currently low on those.
Because one of them moved to Seattle.
One moved to Seattle. One is only two.
Yeah, not helpful yet.
Yeah, so, yeah. But my son Charles, whom you'll probably see at any farmer's market you go to, is the person running them now. Mm-hmm. He's 20, almost 21. And he's really taken it over, and it's great fun. He's bringing a whole new young person's energy to it that is great.
That is great.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. So you sell the vegetables.
Lettuces, herbs, leafy greens. Mm-hmm. And then we grow heritage wheat, and we sell the berries and the flour, and we sell bread.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then another one of your children has a farm of his own also.
Nathan.
Yes.
Maggie's Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And he is also in the process of opening up a restaurant in the Beverly Center called Farmhouse LA.
You guys just like being busy.
We are being busy. But that's his project with his own partners and stuff. But but he is working, you know, this growing up on the farm and having access to all the products that will all be part of the restaurant. So in some ways, we're involved just that way, you know, as the story and also as a supplier.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not our project.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're letting him get all the credit.
He's
doing all the work.
It's his credit. It's his project. Yeah.
So we were laughing before we started because I've interviewed you for television. I've interviewed you for print. And now I'm interviewing you for radio because might as well make it a hat trick, right?
Right.
So I've heard your story before. I'm very well acquainted with it, but I think it's so fascinating. And a lot of people think it's really fascinating because you have been right there in it with California cuisine. And you were not one of the chefs, so you didn't get all of the glory. But you were a big part of what both Alice Waters and Wolfgang Puck did.
Mm-hmm. Well, supply. Yeah, I was in supply.
You were supplying them, but what if you hadn't?
Right. Right. Right.
I just want to make sure that the people who aren't the ones going on the TV shows and publishing the cookbooks and all that, that they get credit too. I really do feel that it's a group effort.
It is, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And when I first started with Alice, she was just starting with her career and getting famous. She had just written her first book and she was on tour and she would bring the salad that I was growing and with her as a kind of hallmark to describe what it was that she was all about and what the movement was all about. So I knew I had a winner.
Yeah, you know? That's amazing.
Like, I should do more of this. Yeah. Having gone to art school, I was always on the lookout for something I could do to make money. You know?
Sure makes sense. And
yeah, because I didn't think that, you know, my sculptures were really going to do it. So,
got it.
I came up with that and it worked pretty well.
So you were living in the Bay Area?
Yes, living in the Bay Area, kind of off the grid. Mm-hmm. Had gone to art school and really was very counterculture. Lived kind of in the underground. I lived on a sailboat.
Oh.
I didn't have a credit card. And I just kind of did everything from scratch and was trying to throw out all the old traditions and replace them with things that I thought were more valuable. And So I was really saying no to a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I had bills to pay. So I had to figure out a way to, you know, to make a living, and had been in the restaurant business a little bit, you know, as a waitress. And
what years are we talking here?
I worked at Chez Panisse in the 70s.
Okay.
I think I was there in 75 through 78 on the floor working there. About those years.
So you were a server there?
I was a server, but it was the early days. And so all of us did different things. Like, you know, I was a server, but I also, you know, put all the butter in the crocks, and I seasoned the soup, and I made all the salads. And sometimes I'd help prep in the kitchen. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff we just did because it was a smaller place and it wasn't as famous back then. It was just getting going.
Okay. Just getting going. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a crush every night, maybe?
It was popular, absolutely, but it wasn't what it became. You know, it had to grow into that.
Right.
So when I was there, there were still, you know, dried commercial, you know, Lurie seasonings like oregano and thyme and stuff on the shelf and things like that that you would never see now.
That is so funny. I'm pretty sure that a bunch of people listening just went,
it was the early days, you know.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, you know, the chefs that worked there were all self-taught. And there's a whole different thing between loving to cook and cooking for your friends and cooking in a restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And so it was very discombobulated and lots of crazy stuff happened and things were late and some things didn't happen. And all of that changed when Jean-Pierre Moulet came on the scene because he was, you know, French trained and he had all of the restaurant skills and he didn't have the ego, which is great.
Oh.
You know? So he just quietly worked there forever, 30 plus years, and was really the anchor, I think, is the unsung hero of Chez Panisse.
So there wasn't, even though he was French trained coming into a group of, dare I say, hippies, there wasn't too much of a culture clash?
Well, they were all Francophiles. They thought everything French was cool.
Okay.
So that was a good thing because he actually was French,
uh-huh.
you know, and he was young. He was in his 20s and very handsome, and he knew a lot about food. So there were lots of connections. But, you know, he was also a very serious restaurant person. You know, in France, that's really like culinary marines. I mean, they don't fool around. And because he was like that and very unassuming, he really got that place whipped into shape. And I think that had a lot to do with it being able to, you know, move forward and become the famous, wonderful place it is because they had this, you know, really solid person in the kitchen.
Right.
Things.
You need some structure to take it to the next level.
Yeah. I wish he'd write a cookbook.
He should.
Yeah. He wrote one with his wife, but I think he should write his own.
Yeah. Let's make him do it. So you were working at Chez Panisse in the 70s, and then you also started growing lettuces. Mm-hmm. And when you started it, was that just whimsically something to do, a hobby?
Well, sort of. I went to art school, and one of my classes was a landscape painting class.
Oh.
And so we would go around, you know, like to Point Reyes and spend the afternoon doing painting landscapes and talking. And just by coincidence, that teacher and a number of the students in the class were gardeners. And I had an interest in how to do things from scratch anyway. That was kind of just part of my sensibility. I kind of noticed that, you know, the old ways were being forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And in high school, I'd started learning about different ways to preserve foods. And I lived in Kentucky for a while and, you know, met up with the Foxfire books and these people who'd been kind of writing down and preserving Appalachian foodways. And I was really fascinated with all of that. So gardening kind of occurred to me, you know, was appealing to me.
I see.
I didn't know anything about it because I was actually a city kid.
Yeah. Were you raised more conventionally and then went off on this path on your own?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was raised in the city with a mom who didn't like cooking and, you know, saw canned food and frozen bird's eye vegetables and, you know, just
the slam mid-century dunk. Standards.
Slam dunk. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really even like to eat, you know, I was just kind of living on apples and peanut butter, I think. But after I left home and, you know, discovered this group of people who gave me little strawberry starts and showed me what to do. And I dug up my backyard. I had this little house in Berkeley with a tiny backyard. And, you know, I grew a few things. I got some strawberry starts and I tasted them and I was like, oh my God. And then I had this zucchini plant and the zucchini got out of control. It was like a great big one, you know, like a 5-pounder. And I was like, I think it must be ready to pick, you know, and I was home alone and I finally thought, I'm going to pick it. And I went in the kitchen. I was like terrified because it was so vibrant sort of and full of life. And I took a knife and I cut into it and I was just like, it's going to bite back. You know? And I cooked it and I ate it. And it really was an epiphany for me because just this freshly cooked, simple thing cooked in a little butter was so delicious that it changed my life. It really did. It was from then on, I was kind of hooked on cooking and on growing things. And I would just grow anything, any seed. I just went nuts and just grew. And some of it was successful and some of it wasn't. But so it came from that, and I had this backyard. I lived on a boat, you know, so after like 1979, I moved onto a Gaffrig schooner.
Then you moved onto a boat.
Yeah, this was after college. But by then I was gardening a little.
Okay.
And since I moved on the boat, a friend of mine, Bob Wax, who's a Chez Panisse person and a cheese boarder and an old guard foodie, said, you can farm in my backyard. So he gave us his backyard, and I did it with his girlfriend and someone else that lived in the house. He had kind of a communal lifestyle. And we planted this garden, the three of us did. And it was just one of those years when everything was right, you know, and it was this most glorious place. And that was the year that Alice kept coming in to raid it, because she kept having people over, like the Random House editor and all this. And one day I was there, and this was when Nathan had just been born. He was like a week old. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry. I've been coming in and taking all the lettuce. And I said, don't worry about it. I have, you know, way too much. It doesn't matter. You don't have to ask for permission. You don't have to apologize for taking it. Just help yourself.
Uh-huh.
And she said, well, if you have too much, you could just bring it by the restaurant and I'll buy it. And I looked at her and I looked at the baby and I was like, okay, I can have too much every day. I'm going to do that. And so that's
amazing. Just like that.
Just like that. And, you know, I developed it over time. I mean, that was the seed that started the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gave me her backyard and we started this little lettuce, French intensive lettuce farm in her backyard. And
just backyard gardening.
Mm-hmm. And we produced a lot of mesclun salad. That was the thing that I could do in numbers that would make a difference. I mean, this was just for the downstairs. It's not a very big restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to produce enough for them.
Just for anyone who doesn't know, there's two stories to Chez Panisse, and they serve different menus, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's an upstairs and a downstairs. And I think that I didn't start the gardens until after the upstairs had been built. I helped work on that, actually. I was on the construction crew for that.
You guys just did a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I was trying to have a big life. And I didn't like, you know, I was a feminist. And so I was like, of course I can be a grunt on a construction crew. And I was working with all these guys and I thought I was pretty fit, but you know, I weighed like 125 pounds.
Right.
They're like, okay, we'll take that wall out. And they're attacking the wall with spades and shovels and the sheetrock is flying and I'm hitting the wall and my shovel is bouncing off. And
oh my gosh. Well, you tried though.
I tried. And then I started making lunch for them, which was the worst, because here I was assuming this role of something I could do, which was feeding them. And I was like, this is not working. So I didn't stay with that.
Why was it not working?
I just wasn't strong enough.
Oh.
I was fit, but I wasn't. It took more brawn than I had, you know?
Got it.
It's kind of a wimp.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were amused, though, to have me around.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet that was funny for them. Fun for them.
It was fun. Yeah.
So you started, when you were doing the backyard gardening, you said that you started with like French lettuces, or at least that's what you found out you could like scale up.
The mesclun, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but at the beginning, was it all sort of experimental?
No, I figured out about the lettuce before I got started.
Okay.
Because I did have some gardening experience and I knew that of all of the things that I could do this cut and come again thing in enough quantity to maybe make a difference.
Uh-huh.
Because restaurants, you know, go through tons of onions and stuff. There's no way that I could do that in a backyard.
Yeah.
So we had a pretty cool thing going for a while with the lettuce, and we would collect all the compostables from the restaurant and make compost.
Uh-huh.
We were doing a pretty fun thing. We had a little worm farm. We had a rabbit farm to have rabbit poop, because that's like gold for gardeners.
Oh, wow.
It was super fun. But, you know, it was super limited, too. It was just for that downstairs. And,
right.
Yeah.
It's small production. You know, it's funny. This doesn't go on so much anymore, but I would say about 4 or 5 years ago, there was that big movement where restaurants, high-end restaurants, were saying that they had their own herb gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd go over there, and it would be like one raised bed about the size of this dining room table.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not a farmer and barely even a gardener, but I thought, well, this doesn't feed a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
This is impossible.
That's right.
So what were they doing? It wasn't just a totally cynical lie to say this.
Well,
it's
just window dressing, I think. In its best sense, it's window dressing. And they probably do clip some herbs and use them in things. I know there's some restaurants in downtown LA that do that. OTM, you know, has like towers with stuff growing in them. And it can't make a very large contribution to their overall need. But at least, you know, it's something they're doing. And
yeah. Yeah, that's true.
It's fine.
It's a nice gesture.
I mean, I think it's important not to say that you're supplying yourself 100%, because then you are lying. But if you just have it there for window dressing, you know, Yeah. It's fine. I mean, the garden space that they have at Manuela is really pretty. They've got a few chickens, and I doubt that any of that is making an enormous contribution, but I think they probably use a lot of that stuff at the bar.
I was thinking muddling
the drinks.
Exactly.
Because you don't need very much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably the main use for these
garnishes, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you think about scaling up, like needing more space?
Right. So I started getting more backyard gardens together, and after a while I had like four different ones. And one of the neighbors from one of the backyards I rented was this food writer. His name is Isaac Cronin. He's still up there in Berkeley. He's written the New American Seafood book, and he wrote a vegetable cookbook, and he's written several things. Mm-hmm. And he was became a friend. And he was the Mr. Mom in the family. And at that time, I had two little kids, and my husband was Mr. Mom. And I was working, and it was kind of fun because they got to be friends, because there weren't very many men doing that back in those days. But his wife was a screenwriter and making money doing that, and I was growing the lettuce and making money doing that. So they were just like two dads, you know, hanging out, talking about diaper sales and going out for coffee.
Right. That sounds nice.
Putting the kids down for naps. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you're better at this than me. This is great. Yeah. You know? And in fact, as a sideline, my second son, who has a daughter now, is the majority caretaker in many ways for his daughter.
Aww.
And I wonder if it's because his dad was that person for him.
Maybe.
You know, maybe
that's
he's really nice. Yeah, it's like passed on.
Yeah.
So anyway, I lost my train of thought. Oh, so he said to me, I've got these friends in LA who were screenwriters, and they have this backyard in Venice, and they really think what you're doing is cool, and they'll give you the backyard if you want to, you know, go to LA and do it. And I was like, why would I do that? You know, I live on a boat. I'm in Berkeley. I've got my scene. LA is so far away, and there's all that smog. And
did you have that San Francisco prejudice against LA before you came down here?
I was a little bit there because I'd only heard bad things about it. And I had been down to LA a little bit because my sister was a punk rocker in the 70s, and we were kind of on the punk rock scene. And the LA scene was really violent in punk venues and stuff. Like, there was a lot of people getting pounded.
Oh, wow.
And so I was at a few shows there, and that happened. And so I had kind of a like idea that LA was a little bit dangerous.
Like, literally bloody.
Like, yeah, you know, and the punks would, you know, pierce their cheeks with safety pins and
good
stuff.
Heavens,
it was pretty hardcore. Yeah. And in the Bay Area, it was, you know, more about fashion and style and music and not so much about fighting.
Okay.
I mean, remember, this was a long time ago and I was young and judgmental. So I had some preconceptions about LA, but when I got here, I really liked it a lot. And the weather is much better. And I could do what I wanted to do, you know, easier because it's sunny so much of the time.
Right.
The people I met, I really liked. I mean, you know that. It's so full of creative people in LA. I mean, it is amazing. And people were helpful and generous and, you know, really took time. And I really felt like I'd finally found a place that I could really be comfortable. And I didn't realize that when I came down here. I thought I was settled already in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Because I'd been there for 13 years and, you know, it seemed like where I would probably stay. But I came down to LA and stayed. I'm still here.
And Wolfgang Puck was part of you moving down here, right?
Right. So my friend Isaac said, you know, Wolfgang Puck would love to have this. And he was a writer, and I was too busy to do anything about it. And I said, okay, I'll pay you $100. You write me a letter. And he needed the money. So so we all needed the money back in those days. We would just like pass $100 to each other. It was just like revolving money, you know.
Yeah.
So he got the $100. He wrote the letter. And Wolfgang Puck got the letter. And he called me. This was before cell phones and email, right? He calls me on my landline on the boat. I pick up the phone and he says, it's Wolfgang Puck. When are you coming? And it's like, well, don't you think we should meet first? And he goes, yeah, when are you coming down? And I said, well, if I'm going to come down, you know, like, I'm going to need some money as an advance to get this set up, because I'm not really, you know, like, that solvent. I can't just come down and do this. I need about $3,000 to get it together. So he sent me a check. He had never met me. He just got my letter, and based on my reputation and my relationship with the people I did know in the Bay Area, he sent me a check for $3,000.
That's amazing. And that was
snail mail.
that's incredible, especially when you think about inflation. $3,000 was a lot more money.
It was a little more money, and it took a great deal of trust. And as soon as that happened, I loved him. I was like, this is a guy.
That's a good way to win people
over. I was like, this is a guy who knows what he wants.
Yeah.
And he's not scared to ask to get it, you know.
Yeah.
And when I met him, he was just, you know, how he is. I mean, if you've ever met him, he's all smiles. And this was a long time ago. He was, you know, pretty young still. And he was just super cute and charming.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, the lettuce is $50 a bus tub. A bus tub is like an unspecified amount, right? It could be a deep tub.
Yeah,
that was a double.
Seriously.
Or it could be a light tub. But I never weighed anything. It was just like in there.
Okay.
You know? And if I decided it was full, it was full. I mean, this was so flaky and seat of the pants. And he didn't care. He was like, yeah, that's fine. No problem. And I was like, you heard me say $50. He's like, yeah, yeah, that's no problem.
And how many bus tubs did he want from you?
Well, he had no idea what he would need. But basically, I got the message that he wanted the product and he was willing to pay whatever I wanted.
Goodness.
And I should have asked for more, but I asked for that. And so I went home and I talked to my husband. And I said, you know, like, I think he's for real. Like, he's not just jerking my chain. And you've got these guys saying they'll give me the backyard.
Uh-huh.
Why don't we just do this?
You yeah. know?
So Dennis was a super open-minded guy. You know, he rode a Triumph motorcycle around the world. And he was also into, like, alternative lifestyles and stuff. Mm-hmm. So he said, sure.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would say no. But he said yes.
Well, there's a reason you guys got married.
Yeah.
Right?
So he said yes. And so we did it.
That's amazing.
And we set up the garden. And then we were going to come back to the Bay Area, you know, and put somebody in to run it. And I was just going to come down and visit.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the people we met were like, yeah, you're not going to leave in 6 months, you know. And I was like, yeah, we are. And they're like, no, you're not going to go. And in fact, they turned out to be right because I didn't leave,
yeah.
you know. So Ruth Reichel was the editor of the food section back then, you know.
For the LA Times?
For the LA Times.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew me from Berkeley and she said, I thought I would do an article about you. And I said, sure. You know, I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
Mm-hmm.
So she did the story of us sailing down on the boat, right, and
yeah.
growing the salad. And
oh, you actually sailed down here?
Yeah, on the sail, on
my
the
goodness.
50-foot Gafford schooner. Yes. Yes, and we had to find a slip, you know, and I had to call the dock masters and say, so we have this beautiful 50-foot Gaffrig Howard Chappelle schooner that needs a dock because, you know, it's kind of a pretty boat. So
okay.
they don't mind, like, tying it up to the guest dock, but you can't stay there forever.
Right.
You know? But it's a good place to start.
Wow.
It was crazy.
That is
such
crazy.
An entrance. So, so she put the story together and they took a picture of me, you know, with my long braids sitting in the garden, like looking like, you know, Central Casting sent a farmer
right.
out, send me a farmer,
mm-hmm.
send me a gardener more like. And it was on the cover of the magazine section for the print edition,
okay.
which is all there was back in those days was the
sure.
print edition.
Yeah.
And I started getting all these letters and phone calls from people in Malibu and all around who had all these big properties saying, you can have my backyard. You
such
can have my backyard.
Such a different time.
It was such a different time. And I just looked at my husband. I'm like, LA is the nicest place on the planet. Everybody is so creative and so generous. And I was still planning to leave. I was saying no thank you to all of these people because, you know, it just, you know, wasn't part of my life plan.
Right.
And then I got this phone call from Larry Silverton. Mm-hmm. Do you know who he is?
I am presumably Nancy Silverton's father.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And she is a big deal chef.
She is a big deal. But back then, we were young, you know,
yeah.
she was still
yeah.
becoming a big deal. She was in New York working at Maxwell Plums, and I think he was missing her. She and I are the same age,
mm-hmm.
I think, about the same age. And he saw the article, and he liked the story,
mm-hmm.
and he called me up, and he said, you know, I've got a half an acre backyard, and you can have it, and it's really nice. It's in Encino, and I was saying no thank you to him, but he was a lawyer, and he was a really good talker. Now, I'm a pretty good talker, too.
Uh-huh.
But he kept me on the phone for probably an hour, and he talked me in to
wow.
coming to see him. He said, you know, I'm only an inch away from you on the map. That's what got me. It was so cute.
That's
and,
really funny.
And I found myself being completely taken in by him because he was such a smooth talker. And, you know, he's a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And he got what he wanted, which was mm-hmm. me to come out and see the place because he knew if I saw it, I would say yes.
Well, that is kind of hilarious for everyone who knows LA that it was Encino that convinced you to stay.
Yeah, totally. And I got out there and I looked around. He goes, you can just have this for as long as you want. I'm like, rent free? And he goes, yeah.
Wow.
And I said, we'll have to take out those two trees. And he goes, no problem.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I know. And so I just did a really quick math equation in my head and I was like, I think I'm going to stay.
Yeah.
So I did. I stayed and I farmed in his backyard.
And then, so you started selling to more restaurants, right?
Yeah. Mostly I supplied Spago. It was actually a really busy restaurant. Spago was in those days, you know, I
yeah.
mean, they were like the place to go.
Right.
And so they went through a lot of salad. They put in a lot of things. And so mostly it was them, but I had a little left over and I, you know, made the rounds to
mm-hmm.
all the places. And then, you know, the junk bond thing happened and there were restaurants popping up like mushrooms all over LA. You know, they were put together by consortiums of dentists and such who all put
right.
in $10,000 and they uh-huh. didn't care if they ever paid a bill. You know, they just like decked it out, had It was like a private dining thing for them, I think. They would like last a year, okay. year and a half. And
so
then
it was
they would
more
close.
Of a feather in the cap type thing than a passion for culinary greatness?
I think so, yeah. I think it was just a thing people were doing. It was like yeah. a fad kind of, you know.
Interesting.
Was, you know, they were open a restaurant. And so
is this mid-80s or still early 80s?
It's mid-80s okay. by then, mm-hmm. yeah. 86 or something like okay. that, I'd say, or 87, like in there maybe. Mm-hmm. I can't believe I remember when. But anyway, so, you know, I had to learn about business. I went to art school, for
right,
God's sake. And
right.
then I learned about farming. And then I had to learn about business. And the great thing was is that Larry Silverton decided to be my mentor.
Ah.
And he knew a lot about business. He was a lawyer, but he was also a real estate guy, and he did a lot of deals.
Okay.
And so every morning after he'd had his espresso, he would come cruising out to the yard, and we would spend an hour, and I would just be, like, plugged into the oracle. He would be talking to me about business, and that's how I got my MBA. You know, I mean, it was so much fun, and he was so knowledgeable, and he was so generous with his information. And I was glued to every word, which I think he liked, you know,
yeah,
because
sure. yeah.
his family members were all like, oh, God, Dad, right. it's Dad, you know, rolling their eyes.
Of course.
It's Dad talking, yeah. you know, and I was just like lapping it up. And so, and people got kind of wondering like, so what's going on with those two? Mm. But it was really just a, you mm-hmm. know, a student and a teacher thing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So when did you switch from considering yourself a gardener to considering yourself a farmer?
Yeah. So then it was right around then when I met him and I got my first, you know, five lessons and how to manage business, I started to expand. Mm-hmm. And so then I considered myself an urban farmer.
Okay.
And I got in touch with the DWP and I discovered that I had like a real streak for business. Like mm-hmm. I'd inherited it from my grandmother and I didn't know that it was there until mm-hmm. I needed it, you know? And then suddenly I was like really able to track things down and make deals and do all this stuff, you know?
Okay.
So I got the DWP to give me a lease and I took out all the orange trees and I had this 7-acre farm in Tarzana under the power lines. And then I had a lot of land, 7 acres, all
yeah.
French intensive, you know, all natural and organic. Nobody cared about organic.
But so why did you know that you wanted to do that already?
Because I was just into the old ways, you know?
Got it.
So. Okay. I was an old ways person.
Yeah.
But I was way ahead of the curve
because right.
nobody cared about that. Like I'd say, well, it's organic. And they're like, yeah, whatever, you know? And then one day I was at the Hotel Bel Air and the maitre d' came rolling in. He was this big, handsome, tall guy in a black suit. And he says, I can't believe it. I served a salad and there was a snail on the lettuce and it's just terrible. You don't wash it well enough. And I looked at him. I'm like, I don't wash it at all. That's your job. So it turned out that for years, they had been putting my salad on the table without ever washing it because it looked pretty clean.
That is amazing.
As far as I know, no one ever got sick and died. But it did create this whole wrinkle in business for the whole triple washed thing, you know, like whole machines were invented to produce this washed product and all this food safety came into play and all these things happened because they started, you know, shipping it, right? So it mm-hmm. had to last. Well, I was just selling locally, like I was picking in the afternoon and people were eating it that night. I think
amazing.
That's
wow.
why we never had a problem.
Because it
know?
Still looked all vibrant.
It was super vibrant. It wasn't very dirty because mm-hmm. the way it was grown nice and close together and I overhead watered it. So it was always getting kind of a little shower.
Ah, yes.
So it was pretty clean.
It was kind of washed.
It was washed-ish.
Yeah.
You know? And we didn't have a problem, but I think it was really the freshness was our protector just because, mm-hmm. you know, we were hyper-local and we didn't store it in a cooler or anything. We just mm-hmm. pick it and deliver it.
But eventually you did start selling stuff to non-locally.
Well,
is that the term?
Little bit. I mean, in 2008, we got into Whole Foods Southern Pacific region, and they put us in all their stores eventually, not right away. So they handle that shipping part of it.
Okay.
So it does go to a couple of stores in Arizona, Nevada, and to Hawaii.
But oh, all the way to Hawaii.
Yeah, wow. They have some stores there. But and I've had friends go to the Whole Foods there and send me snaps.
You ask for photos?
Them. Yeah.
See how it holds up?
Yeah, and it holds up great. But I mean, I think it's partly because they do such a good job. And we are picking and delivering every day to them.
Okay.
And so I think it's still pretty fresh. You know, we haven't gotten into like cross-country shipping or mm-hmm. anything just because.
And that's, you know, under the Kenter Canyon label, correct? Mm-hmm. And is it boxes or bags?
It's clamshells, unfortunately. Yeah.
Wow. You can't be perfect in every way.
I'm trying. But I failed in that yeah. Lots of clamshells.
Isn't that a situation where it's not totally up to you? It has to be negotiation with the seller
yeah,
as well.
They want
the
it.
Retail
that's
seller.
Why, Because I wanted them to stay with loose pack and people serve themselves. But they had, I guess, too much shrink or something, you know. And so they like this.
Yeah. So. Well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Business. Mm-hmm. And then so you were down here. You were getting bigger as a lettuce and herb grower. And then you said that you liked L.A., decided that you wanted to stay here. Mm-hmm. And yet you had to keep going up to the Bay Area because the food down here was still not great.
That's true. I have said that. It's on record. So there used to be these great cheap trips. Like I think it was $49 round trip on PSA. Mm-hmm. You could go from Burbank to Oakland. Uh-huh. And so I would do that and go grocery shopping.
That is hilarious.
I would go to Pete's and get coffee, and I would get bread, uh-huh. and I would get like a few other things. Like, and I would have two grocery bags and two kids on the plane. I knew I couldn't keep doing that. It was so ridiculous. I mean, all of my friends were rolling their eyes. They were just horrified that I would be such a snot, you know? Mm-hmm. And like once a month I was driving my car up there to do a big shopping, you know?
Wow.
Mrs. Gucci's kind of turned up on the scene, and that helped a little bit.
What is Mrs. Gucci's?
It was what Whole Foods bought. It was a health food store down here in the beginning. And so we kind of started shopping there, and I started even more, you know, I started making bread. I mean, mm-hmm. basically that's why I started and I roast coffee.
Oh.
Because of that.
Okay.
So we roast our own coffee and
wow,
bake our own bread. And
do you grow your own coffee yet?
No. I import it. Through Sweet Maria's, it's Guatemalan coffee. But I mean, we're like getting, you know, green beans mm-hmm. and 50-pound bags.
That's
and
fantastic.
Roasting coffee every week. And
so you've recently, semi-recently expanded into growing wheat. And mm-hmm. does it seem true that that interest in growing wheat actually came from your interest in eating bread first?
Yes, it did. It did. So it was all about the bread game. So I was baking bread for years and years. And it was a sandwich bread. It was a sesame millet bread that I was copying from there's a Vital Vittles bakery up in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And they were one of the very early whole grain milled wheat bakeries. And they're still there. Mm-hmm. So they had a big stone mill and they would mill their wheat and they would bake this bread. They had like six different breads, but the sesame millet was the one I really liked. And so I kind of attempted to copy that bread. And that's the bread I made for my family for mm-hmm. years. And then I was on a vacation in Switzerland, and I ran across this little Como home-sized mill for milling mm-hmm. wheat, and I just had to have it. I got the wants really bad. You know how that is?
Got
sometimes
the wants.
I was just like,
I love that.
I just like got this feeling, and my husband saw the look in my eyes. He goes, "No, I'm not dragging that thing around for the rest of our vacation." So I ordered it online this year when I got here.
It's a great solution.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful, you know, machine. It has, you know, it's just home-sized and it's clad in dug fur like this kitchen is, you mm-hmm. know, so I knew it would blend in. And I started milling my own wheat. Mm-hmm. And my bread game really went up after that. Like the freshly milled wheat just produced bread that was – and I'd been baking a while, so I knew how to bake. It wasn't, you know, and I could really see the difference. The loaf was shinier. The flavor was better. And yeah, I got really into baking.
And were you yet at that point where you were like testing different kinds of wheat?
Not yet. No, I was just buying wheat berries from Bob's Bread Mill, mm-hmm. you know.
And they just have the one kind or
did
at the
time? Well, I was just buying hard red wheat. I didn't really know very much about it. And then.
Well, not many people do.
Yeah, I was just going with what I did know. But as I got interested in it, I started researching it, talking to people. And, you know, that opened up Pandora's box. I mean, I joined LA Bread Bakers and there were other wheat nerds out there besides me. And I started really digging in, you know, and learning about it and talking to people and researching old varieties and got mm-hmm. in touch with people who are already doing that. And mm-hmm. it just one thing led to another. And then one day while I was milling, I looked at the wheat berries and I was like, oh my God, these are seeds. You know, it just like took me forever to put that together. I mean, all I do is farm.
Right.
And I was looking at seeds all this time right. and I didn't go, oh yeah, I could grow that, mm-hmm. you know? And when I did, you know, we went ahead and did it first at Nathan's farm. Mm-hmm. We just did a little test patch and it got eaten up by wildlife.
Oh no.
Yeah. So the second year we did it again. And then we found out what the wildlife was that was eating it. It was ground squirrels.
Oh.
And we had this great nature lesson because the ground squirrels from the year before mm-hmm. had a huge population explosion because they were so well fed on the wheat that they'd stolen from me that the next year it was like a major infestation of ground squirrels.
Oh,
and they
gosh.
Were so bold. It was ridiculous.
Wow.
They would come out in broad daylight, reach up, grab a stalk, chew it off, and go into their hole with it.
Wow. Like,
you could watch them do it.
That is bold.
They didn't even care. They weren't even sneaking around.
Good heavens. And they just wanted that wheat.
They were just like totally overweight.
Right.
Like...
They were carved up. So there are different types of wheat.
Right.
And they have different names. And back in like the 1800s, there would be farm catalogs of different mm-hmm. wheats you could buy. And the descriptions would talk about what they were good for in terms of pies or bread or cookies or whatever. And then also the different flavors that each one had. Because, I mean, it certainly was a surprise to me when I found out that different wheats had different flavors.
They do. Different colors.
Mm-hmm.
Different flavors. And it all comes through in the finished product if you don't sift it all off. So mm-hmm. if you're using whole wheat, it's amazing, you know. I mean, I never get bored with it, you know.
Do you try different kinds of wheats still?
For different things. Oh, yeah. We grow 6 different ones now.
Amazing.
I mean, there's so many more. And I would grow more, but I just, you know, I'm kind of maxed out at mm-hmm. this point in terms of land and production. There's a lot to it, actually. But I'll buy wheat from other people that have varieties that I want to try occasionally. Mm-hmm. There's so many good ones. But we've just had a ton of fun with it. You know, we try
What's your go-to basic wheat?
Well, all the 6 that I grow, the one we probably use the most of is the Glen. And then we have a field blend called Sonora Fife, mm-hmm. which they both bake really good bread. And we've been mostly focused on bread, but now I'm branching into sweeter things like cookies and, mm-hmm. and scones and things like that. And so I'm trying out the other wheats, Emmer and Sonora.
Okay.
Yeah. And
are these all heritage grains?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they all are, Glen, I think, was introduced in the 1950s, and I don't exactly know what the cutoff is to be considered a heritage wheat, but I think if you're, you know, if you were in production before 1956,
okay,
you know, then you get to be called a heritage. So there's heritage and there's ancient, right? The ancient mm-hmm. ones are, you know, really old. Some of them are really old.
Right. Like, I almost said biblical, but really pre-biblical.
Yeah, mm-hmm. sure. You know, I mean, supposedly wheat has been found in Egyptian tombs that was still viable because, you know, it's nice and dry there and stored well.
That's so incredible.
Yeah, it's thousands of years. Yeah, wow. It's amazing.
You also said, though, that these heritage grains, at least at this point, maybe aren't viable. Like you can't redo the processed bread industry, like the supermarket bread industry with heritage grains. Is that still the case? Are they still more expensive to obtain?
Well, you know, it's a big question. I mean, I have been coming up against that because, you know, you kind of have to figure out how far you can take a project, you know, before it gets too big to do.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the handicaps for what I'm doing is that I'm doing sourdough starter and, it has a long ferment, you know, so I have to build the starter and then my bread has to ferment for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need a lot of notice for the orders, and most people can't get that together, right?
Yes.
They want to order it the day before they get it.
Yes.
And so I think that that kind of thinking is partly what fueled the bread economy that we see today, which is so lousy, you know.
Right.
It was also, I think, partly fueled by wanting to create an inexpensive product because people were still hungry. There still is a lot of food insecurity in the United States. And I think that some of the bread industry, you know, industrializing it was just to get more bread to more people, mm-hmm. you know? So that was kind of a good thing. But, you know, in the process of taking out all of the wheat bran and everything, they took all the nutrition out and then they try to put it back in with vitamins and it's just not the same.
Right.
You know, they've created a product that isn't as healthful as if they stayed with whole wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it could be possible for them to do just yeast raised breads using whole wheat and still put out an awful lot of bread. And I'd like to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I'm going to do, but
you've got enough on your plate.
I'm just doing this hyper-local thing. I'm not trying to get out beyond mm-hmm. here.
Mm-hmm. But on a countrywide, maybe even worldwide level, lots of people get really concerned about GMO wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Is there such thing as GMO wheat?
Well, it probably exists in labs, but it's not in the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because it's globally traded. Our wheat in the United States is sold all over, and a number of our major buyers wouldn't touch it if it had GMOs in it. So mm-hmm. we've been protected because of that. That said, I hate to be anti-science, and I don't think that GMOs are altogether bad.
Yeah, it's
don't
kind
shoot
of a,
me.
Well, no, it's a continuum, right? Because
right.
there's GMOs, there's almost naturally occurring GMOs like pluots, plum apricot hybrids. That mm-hmm. just comes from grafting. But then there's the foods that are created in a lab. are marketed as being healthful in some particular way, and then the farmers who plant it have to sign a contract, and they are forever beholden to a certain chemical company.
Yeah, that whole thing is heinous. I agree.
That's why.
But the science of it, I think it's important to be open to the possibility that some of those products are probably not so terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there's some creepy things out there. I'm not denying that, mm-hmm. but it's not all bad. And I just don't like people to just automatically dismiss science, because it seems very small-minded to me.
Right. And yeah. I think that's why when people say, oh, you can't buy bread because it's GMO.
That's not GMO true.
Wheat. Right. It's not true. And it's a knee-jerk reaction to something that maybe wouldn't be terrible. But I also wanted to ask you another thing about gluten, because my theory is that gluten intolerance is increasing because the bread is so processed, and processing wheat is what increases the gluten. Gluten is a protein.
Right. So what they do when they go to the, I believe this is the reason, I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. So the wheat berry is a great thing, you know, nutritionally a very compact little package of goodness. But when it goes to the mill, they separate all the parts, right? And then they recombine the flour to be particular types of flour for different projects. And the high gluten wheat flours have more endosperm in them than they originally would have had if you just, if you took the wheat berry and you milled it and you sifted it and you took the sifted flour and made bread, that wouldn't be as bad as the flour having had an extra endosperm added back in. So the percentage of endosperm per that massive amount of flour is higher.
Ah.
So you've got more protein to process, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a lot fewer of the, you know, extra things that help you process the foods, all the micronutrients and things that help with the digestion, the fibers and so on and so forth to help you with the process of digestion. And you have these very strong flours, which are great for going through machines, and they're in everything. You know, those flours are the flours that they use mainly, those high gluten flours. I think that it's just a reaction to that, you know.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
If you switch to whole wheat flour, especially if you switch to sourdough raised breads, a lot of people will find that they can tolerate that because the acids in the sourdough starter are actually helping to kind of pre-digest that protein.
Yeah.
And there's no extra protein. It's just the protein from that particular amount of wheat. You know, it's not fortified at all.
And we're not being crazy people. We're not saying that it'll cure your Crohn's disease. We're just talking about people who get the toots from pizza.
Yeah. Or whatever. Or get a stomach ache or feel bloated or what, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a more pleasant way to live if you don't feel bloated after every meal.
Right.
It's my
right.
understanding.
I completely agree. And also, if you eat too much bread, you're going to get fat, which is the other thing. So people have, you know, lifestyles that are most, you know, sedentary more than they used to probably. And they're eating lower fiber foods, you know, higher sugar. It's a combination of things. So the microbiome is really not optimal.
Right.
And so when you start talking about microbiomes, you know, you're really getting into the heart of what's the problem with most people, you know, their microbiome isn't functioning properly. You're not getting the right messages to your body about what it is you need.
And do you think that's because of our contemporary diet?
Yeah, it's a lack of exercise and a lack of fiber in the diet and just a lack of whole foods and, you know, too much alcohol and sugar and all those things which, you know, are going to create acid balances that influence what can and can't thrive in your body. But if you have a nice, healthy microbiome, you know, your immune system's working great and, you know, you're full of energy and...
But American society these days is really set up to not let us be our fullest, healthiest selves.
Yeah, that's true a lot of places.
Like you have to work 8 hours a day or you'll get fired. Doesn't matter if you have work or not, your butt's got to be in the seat in most jobs. And then food marketing. We've talked about this before at length on this show before, but it's like, yeah, you got to sell a product, but also it's kind of evil because it's not food in terms of this will sustain you. It's what's not going to sustain you is what gets marketed.
Yeah,
the
like Red Bull, you know, or something like that. But Red Bull makes up for it by, you know, giving money to all kinds of, you know, indie stuff.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
You do the evil to make the money to give to the good.
I know. I have a problem with that, but I also like them for doing it because they have done a lot of interesting things, you know, for skateboarders and artists. And
Yeah,
it's interesting, isn't it?
Oh, this planet.
I know. But that's, you know, humans.
Yeah.
We're our own worst enemy.
Yeah. Always. Always. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Can people order your bread from anywhere or do they got to be in person?
I don't ship, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need to go to our bakery in Fillmore Wednesdays and Saturdays. Just check out our website. There's availability page there. Rowanmills.com.
Rowanmills.com. And that's R-O-A-N Mills.com.
R-O-A-N. Mills with an S.
Well, thank you for really fulfilling the trifecta of video, print, and now radio and telling me your story for a third time. And I still love it. It's such a good story.
Thank you. I had so much fun.
Good.
Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. Bye.
Bye.